Broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University, this is WSDL Ocean City 90.7 FM, Delmarva Public Radio. It's time now for a special writer's edition of Delmarva Today with host Harold Wilson.
My mother knew non-publication's shame. Obscurity's abyss, where blind hands flog typewriter keys in hopes of raising up the magic combination that will sell. Instead, brown envelopes return bent double in letter slots to flop on the foyer floor, or else abandoned flat within the tin of the rural mailbox as insects whir. She studies how to diagrammed great plots, some correspondence course assigned, read Mann, Flaubert, and Faulkner looking for the clue, the open sesame to fling the cave door back and flood with light the shadows of her heart to turn them golden, worth their weight in cash. Mine was to be the magic gift instead. Propelled by confidence, by mother love, and polished for the New York market by New England's wintry flair for education. But hers was the purer ambition, hatched of country childhood in the silences of crops accruing. Her sole companion birds, whose songs and names she taught herself to know. Her gray head cocked, she'd say, the chickadee feels lonely. Bent above a book, she'd lift her still young face and say, such ugly words, as if each stood alone. No, no, I thought, context is all. But I was male and made to make a mark, while mother typed birdsong. John Updike, in his book Endpoint and Other Poems. Welcome to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. We're talking about the craft of writing today, and there are no better experts on the subject than my two guests, Lynn Old Schwartz and Laura Oliver. Laura Oliver is the author of The Story Within, and both are mentors and writing workshop instructors at St. John's College in Annapolis. Laura and Lynn also teach at the Beta Ocean Writers Conference, sponsored by the Eastern Shore Writers Association. Lynn and Laura, welcome to Delmarva Today, Writers Edition.
Thank you very much for having us.
Let me ask you first off, what is a mentor as far as writing is concerned?
Well,
Laura?
I would say a writing mentor, the way Lynn and I practice this anyway, would be someone that offers one-on-one instruction, inspiration, and encouragement to writers, sort of as a companion on that journey, and at the individual's pace.
Lynn?
Yes, that's absolutely true. More specifically, I think we both provide manuscript assessments or story development editing with the hope to get it the manuscript in publishable shape. But as Laura said, everybody's working at their own level. So that may be trying to find a story, get it on the page with just an idea, or it could mean reviewing an entire manuscript.
And so this is working one-on-one with an individual writer.
Right.
For you. Well, you both teach at St. John's, leading writing workshops. What else do you have coming up?
Well, we're very excited about our second annual writing intensive at St. John's College, which this year will be May 21st from 9:15 in the morning until 6 o'clock. We're going to have an incredible staff of instructors, and we have breakfast, lunch, and a question and answer forum, and a wine reception afterwards at which people can mingle with the instructors and other participants. So we're both really happy to be able to do that again. It was a huge success last year.
Well, in addition to what sounds like good food, what's the content of the workshop?
Well, it's a full day of I think this year we have 9 workshops. They run 1 hour long, and an attendee can choose 5 of them. So it addresses different levels: character, memoir, nonfiction, fiction, and different levels.
Well, it sounds like an exciting May for you, I think. For our listeners, let me mention that I have a bonus for all of you today at the end of the program that you won't want to miss. So make sure you stay for that bonus. We open the program with a poem by John Updike, a magnificent writer and certainly well compensated for his talent. At the same time, though, he says that his mother, who never published, had the purer ambition, and she wrote Birdsong. I think that, first of all, most of us write because we think we have something to say. We believe we have something to say. And secondly, we write because we want to share what we have to say with others. We want to make them a part of our world, as it were. And thirdly, we all like to hear a good word, like, well done. And perhaps, just perhaps, we might receive a half penny or a farthing for our effort. But the greatest desire of all is to write Birdsong. Lynn and Laura, both of you are masters of the craft of writing. What do we have to do to make our words sing?
Well, Hal, I'm going to answer that because I'd like to share with your listeners an excerpt from The Story Within, which was published by Penguin Random House, because it sort of addresses what you're talking about. And it goes like this. It's from the chapter on getting started. And getting started is all about how to get from an idea to words that sing on the page. It is the physical act of writing that inspires ideas. It's a biological response from your right brain, the artist, whenever your left brain, the logical litigator, is engaged. It's not necessary to wait for an idea to come first. Writing without inspiration, however self-consciously, primes the pump of imagination and memory. It signals to your inner writer in ways both obvious and more subtle that you are ready to receive. Think of it like this. You're not trying to make a story up. You're trying to let the story within get out. It's like running for the edge of a cliff with a hang glider. The run is awkward. You stumble a bit. You are burdened by your wings, but you keep running. At some moment, you're off. You're no longer straining for momentum, but soaring on the wind. Maybe it will take you a page or more to know whether this story is going to stay aloft, but you can jettison your exploratory paragraphs later if they're unnecessary. As you continue to write, details will begin to accrete. They will grow in depth and weight and take form. The early emptiness of space contained little more than helium and hydrogen, but elements combined and recombined and became something weighty and new. Eventually, characters will ignite and burn bright on the page. There, they will gravitate toward each other, which, interestingly, everything with mass tends to do.
Is this what you do when you write, Laura?
I do believe that I write not because I have something to say, but because I have something to discover. I write in order to understand what has happened to me, whether that's in the form of a character or it's a piece of memoir which I acknowledge and own as my own experience.
I think that's an incredibly important insight you've laid out in your book, because so many books that I read are basically he did, she did, they did, and you get a narrative that just kind of lays out a series of events without having the real content of life it pour out of them. And so to write the way I believe you have expressed the story within is really to let things happen in your mind. And then as they flower, and as your imagination grows and fills in the parts of this story, you use the element of craft to take that imagination and transfer it to a piece of paper, which is no easy thing to do. What are these elements of craft? We hear a lot about them, but we're going to talk about the major elements. What do you feel are some of the major elements of craft?
Well, for me, I'm sure there could be many, but for me, the main elements of craft are character, plot, dialogue, setting, point of view, style,
voice.
There we go. So these are tools, you know, that you use to be able to tell your story well, so that you can engage a reader. Because no matter how good your idea is, if you don't make the story compelling, the reader won't keep turning the page.
I think you say, and I've thought about this a little bit, you say that the elements of craft are tools, but they sound, before we talk about plot here, which I think is the first one we want to talk a little bit about, to what degree are the elements of craft also the content that, for instance, dialogue is an element of content to the story? We think of them as tools, and I know I do too. But in thinking about the elements of craft, I was thinking of tools. I was thinking you build a house, you have a hammer, and that's a tool. But you also have wood, which is part of the content of what you're building. Am I wrong here, or is there a relationship between tool and content of your story?
Well, I think the content is your plot, right? What is the story you're trying to tell? And then when we talk about elements of craft, I just want to go back a little bit and point out, craft is a skill, and it takes practice to get better at it. So we have to practice dialogue to get better at it.
Just like if you're building a house, you've got to know how to use the saw and the hammer.
Exactly. You can have the best wood of all, but if you don't know how to use that hammer, you're not going to make anything beautiful.
No, I believe that's correct. Well, what is a plot? Tell us what a plot is.
I would say, in a word, a plot is a problem. I mean, there are a lot of definitions of plot, from nothing is as it appears, or someone goes on a trip and a stranger comes to town. I mean, there are many definitions. But in essence, something has to be wrong. There has to be a puzzle, a mystery, a question, someone in jeopardy, stakes. But in a nutshell, someone has to have a problem, and we have to be interested in whether or not they solve it and the obstacles that are put in their place along the way.
I've read, relative to plot, I've read that everyone in a story has to want something. And something in the story has to keep that person from getting right. what they want. Do you see plot at all like that? Well, is that what you're saying?
The other definition is plot is what someone wants and what she's willing to do to get it.
If there are no obstacles, if everything goes right, there is no story. That's what story is, how we overcome or not the obstacles.
I like also Aristotle. I think Aristotle's Poetics. If you've not heard about Aristotle's Poetics, I really encourage you to read at least the Spark Notes summary, because Aristotle wrote out the formula for the great dramas, the great Greek dramas. And the way he defined plot is very similar to what you're saying, but he talks about two things. One is there has to be what he calls, anyway, a reversal. Somebody wants something, and then something happens that reverses the process. Does that make any sense to the two of you?
Well, I think often when a character starts out, this is the hero's journey as well. Often if a character starts out wanting something to go on that quest for a particular thing, once they're pulled out of their ordinary world, often they don't arrive at the place, the destination where they thought they would. Often it's something very different. You know, this happens all the time in romantic comedy. A girl who is getting married to the trouble guy, but she can't see that, and her male best friend, who's always been nice and helpful and loving her, she doesn't see that till the end. And so that's often the twist in the romantic comedy, that your destination ends up to be something very different that you thought you wanted.
Just like in life.
Right. Well, that's exactly right. And you were saying earlier that the story grows in your mind. And so, relative to plot, is the plot something that you know in advance, that you are all clear about in your story, what the plot elements are going to be?
I think it may be different for different writers. There are writers who completely plot out their books in advance, but it isn't something that I encourage people to do, nor do I do it myself. I really do believe that the best writing, the most compelling writing, is a discovery on the page. And even when you think you know what your book is about, it really is something you're going to discover, if it's fiction, as your characters tackle the problems you've set before them. And if it's memoir or personal essay, as you go deeper and deeper into the experience and uncover what really was going on and matters of the mind and heart.
And I agree with that. I have a favorite quote about that subject I'd like to share with you. And this is by Flannery O'Connor. And she says, if you start with a real character, then something is bound to happen, and you don't have to know what before you begin. In fact, it may be better if you don't know what before you begin. You ought to be able to discover something from your stories. If you don't, probably nobody else will. And I think that's exactly what Laura is saying.
Good, Flannery O'Connor and I agree.
Well, I'm pleased at least
we have
agreement here, but that does move us into character a little bit. What is a character in a story?
Lynn?
Well, a character in the story is the person whose journey we are witnessing. They're the ones who are being confronted by the obstacles. They're the ones that yearn for something and can't get it, and we're going to follow their journey till the end and hopefully learn something from it. That's when the reader engages, if we're invested in that character.
Yeah, I agree with that. And as far as making those characters real, no one is all good or all bad. I mean, if you do that, you've got white hats and black hats, you've got good guys and bad guys, and that's the stuff of comic books. Or quintessential writing. And instead, if you can, even with a villain, put tears in his eyes at some point, or anything that shows both the shadow and the light side of your character, they'll certainly be more real. And that really includes descriptions. I see students all the time describe characters in terms of eye color, hair, and height. And that's just not as memorable as describing a character from the inside out. Is he the kind of guy who parks at red curbs? Is she the kind of woman who's not wearing a wedding ring? What can you tell us about your character that makes them more memorable than eye color and hair?
Right. This, I think, and I agree with Laura, and I'm just adding on here because this is one of the biggest mistakes I come across, and I'm sure you do too, in beginning writing, is that the character enters and now we describe them head to toe, blonde hair, red lips. But what psychologically about them, what choices does a character make in how they look? If I have green hair, that says something about me because it's a choice the character makes.
Right. It's a character, of course, is crucially important to any piece of fiction, and I think you're absolutely right, because what one of the subtleties, it seems to me anyway, of character is that characters change. And so one of the elements of plot may well be that this character changes somewhere. However, Laura, based on what you said, it seems to me that early on there needs to be some element that makes that change later on possible. That it's a real person, that there's some characteristic that once the change happens, you think, oh yeah, back there, he patted the dog. Mm-hmm. Back there, he did something very subtle that said, this guy isn't, or woman isn't, all bad.
Well,
here,
I think what happens is that we're trying to create a certain empathy or a certain ability for our readers to identify with a character. And the way we do that, in a nutshell, is through showing a character's vulnerability. It's at the point of vulnerability that we trust and connect and root for and become closely identified. And that doesn't matter whether it's fiction or it's memoir, but showing our vulnerabilities, showing our needs, is then showing the potential for growth and transformation. And I think we do read for transformation, even if it's subtle, even if it's just a change in self-perception. Readers want something to be different about your main character at the end of a story than it was when the story began. Otherwise, what is the point of the telling? You're always asking yourself, why am I telling this story, and why am I telling it now?
Vulnerability is a wonderful word for character. How do you sketch that vulnerability into your character? What do you do that makes them real, so that you feel that they are vulnerable and you have some empathy for them? What happens in the story that allows the reader to pick up on that?
Well, I think to have empathy, and I think, as Laura said before, we don't want our characters to be perfect. We can't identify with them then. So a reader wants to understand a character's flaws, whether they're the protagonist or the villain. We don't have to like them, but we need to understand what makes them tick. So we want to know, what is your character afraid of? Or what do they regret? Or what do they yearn for? What are their life mistakes? And how will these mistakes haunt them as they go forward on this journey? And I think all of that helps to create empathy.
What's the relationship between character and plot? How do those two interplay?
Well, there is one quote that says, plot is basically the choices a character makes, and crucially, the choices a character makes under pressure. The choices you have when you can just sit back and think about it for a couple of days are one thing, but character is revealed when, in an instant, you have to decide, are you going to dive off the subway platform and cover the body of a child when the train's coming? So that's one way in which those two collide.
I think, for me, I was really influenced several years ago, and I think Laura would agree with this, by Robert Olin Butler. We used to think of character wanting or needing or desiring something. And he said, no, it's what a character yearns for, which we may have mentioned, which takes it, that makes it deeper. And so he says that the desire is the driving force behind the plot. The character yearns, the character does something in pursuit of that yearning, and some force or other will block the attempt to fulfill that yearning. The character will respond to the force in some way, go round or through or over or under, and continue the pursuit. This dynamic beneath the story is plot, the attempt to fulfill the yearning, and the world's attempt to thwart that. And we've been talking about that already, but I think it's important to emphasize it, and Robert Olin Butler says that so well. But it's really the character's motivations to attain that yearning is what's going to organically drive the plot.
And is that the way we identify with the character and to some extent with the story? Is that those we appropriate those emotions? What happens to the reader?
I would think that when the reader is identifying closely with the vulnerabilities of that particular character, then they're going to be completely caught up in the choices he makes and therefore the plot of the story, and that's going to keep him turning pages.
If you become curious, you become invested in that character. You may not be just like that character, but you become invested and interested. Mm-hmm. So as Laura says, you'll turn the page to find out if he'll be okay.
I wonder if there is also something in there that says I could be this character, or how would I, as a reader, how do I become invested in this character? By saying what would I do? Why do I feel this way about this character?
Well, the only way I can really answer that is that the latest discoveries in brain science show that our brains are actually hardwired to respond to story, because it's a way in which we vicariously get to experience problems without actually being in jeopardy. So one way to answer that question is simply that when we are reading and we are invested in what happens and whether or not there's a good outcome, it's partly because from our armchair, we're getting a vicarious lesson. Thank God I don't have to have terminal cancer. Thank God I don't have to be the person under fire in Iraq, but I can learn from this experience.
And I can feel what this character is feeling. But I think you're absolutely right. In the beginning was story. Before anything else, the hunting story about how to find game, the hunting story about how to cook, the hunting story about where we ought to move.
It says, Muriel Rukhauser says, the world is not made up of atoms. The world is made up of story.
No, I can understand that. Well, there is the plot, there's the character, and there's the setting, because everybody's got to be somewhere, right? So we're going to take a short break now, and my guests are Lynn Old Schwartz and Laura Oliver, and we're talking about the craft of writing. And don't forget, I have a bonus for you at the end of the program, so please stay with us.
Have you ever heard an idea that changed the way you look at the world?
Everything we think,
we've had
feel.
To believe in impossible
infinite
things.
Infinite possibility, and that sense of potential. And I realize
and we've had to refuse
persist.
To fear failure.
You've got to persist through failure.
You can contemplate the meaning of infinity.
I'm Guy Raz. Join me each week for Ideas Worth Spreading on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Sunday morning at 10 on WSDL.
Welcome back to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. My guests are Lynn Old Schwartz and Laura Oliver, and we're talking about the craft of writing. And don't forget that at the end of the program, I have a bonus for you. As I said before our break, everybody has to be somewhere. So all of our characters are carrying out our plot in some kind of setting. How important is setting in the story that we're creating here?
I think setting is crucial, and it's one of the most underutilized, I believe, or undervalued elements of craft. You're saying everyone has to be somewhere. I would say everything happens somewhere, and that means
no. You're not going to let go. You're not going to let go of that story element, are you? Everything happens. Everything is a story,
and every
story happens somewhere. Okay.
All right. And so setting can enrich, it can foreshadow, it anchors your story. It also makes stories memorable. We often forget what happened, but we rarely forget where it happened, even leading to plot. I mean, there are settings which actually become the plot, like The Perfect Storm or the Emma Donoghue's Booker-winning novel Room, which all takes place in a room, in a shed, where she's been kidnapped and held captive. And now, I believe that movie has just come out, based on the book. The entire plot is absolutely based upon the setting. Settings also are the one element of craft that have to appeal to all the senses, or at least have that ability, whereas character might not. But in a setting, what can you hear? What can you smell? What can you touch? What
you mean
see?
Our characters don't have to smell, Laura?
They might not be described in terms of they can hear.
Oh, okay. The musty old man odor.
Right.
And I think sometimes, too, Laura's saying that the setting can become plot. I think sometimes they're so emphasized they become a character in the book. I mean, I always remember from high school, and I reread it and recommend people read Ethan Frome again. It's a wonderful little book. And it takes place in Starkfield, Massachusetts. Well, even the name sounds bleak. And that setting is all about the winter and themes of winter as physically and psychologically oppressive. So the setting is doing things to our characters. So it becomes a character as well.
Well, when you think about Gordon Gekko and Wall Street, I mean, it's like Gordon Gekko wouldn't have been Gordon Gekko anyplace but Wall Street. Or Scarlett O'Hara. Scarlett O'Hara was a product of the Southern plantation. Yeah. So without that setting, she wouldn't have been Scarlett O'Hara.
Right. So how do we sketch out then the setting? What are, to use our word, elements again, what are the elements of setting? You mentioned the five senses, mm-hmm. but what are the other elements of setting that play a role, for instance? One of the elements of the Perfect Storm, for instance, is the storm itself. You've got the wind, you've got the rain, you've got the sea, you've got the boat, the ship that they're in. In terms of setting, where do we find the elements of setting that we bring together to create what I guess we're talking about is a mood, first of all. The setting creates a mood. And then, again, like The Perfect Storm, it becomes an element of the plot.
Well, imagination, memory, and research, I'd say, would be ways in which you find your setting and make it come to life.
And you'd ask yourself, why? What is the story? Why is it happening now in this moment? So what is the setting for that? Where is it taking place?
And you're
you
right.
You need to know that for the story.
Psychologically, I mean, the setting can come through the eyes of a character. So a depressed character, for instance, you can show through what that character notices something about the setting and let the setting reflect that depression. A depressed character will not describe a room with vivid colors and will go for a walk and notice the litter along the sidewalk, whereas you can use the same setting to show that that person is perhaps euphoric, just received good news or is in love, and what they're noticing isn't the litter at all. They're seeing the color of the sky and the sound of the birds.
That's an excellent point. That's probably really the key to it. The character's outlook is going to be different for how you describe it for each character. So that's really important, I think.
The setting can also drive the plot as well, can't it?
Well, as it did in Room, absolutely, because the entire plot becomes the need to escape the setting. Setting can become the plot. There was a book I read as a child that I loved, The Wonderful Flight to the Mushroom Planet. And there the entire plot was getting to the mushroom planet. So sure.
I was thinking a woman, a long-term professor at a university is getting fired for who knows what. And she walks into the boardroom where the regents are meeting. And the first thing she sees, and that we see in the boardroom, is that there are 9 men in black suits sitting around the table. Glasses have the dregs of an amber liquid in them. So the meeting has been going on for a while. Mm. There are paintings on the wall. All men. And she is not offered a chair. I mean, and that's all setting. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But just from that description where she is, you know two things about this woman. She's got a problem, and she sees the room, and she's angry. But anyway, I guess that's what I'm trying to say about setting and how setting can tell you what's going on in the mind of the character.
And that happens a lot in the movies, right? That's how a lot is conveyed to us through that.
No,
that's what
exactly.
You're describing.
We've talked about how characters relate to plot. But in our story, it is usual that people are talking. Mm-hmm. And one of the elements of story is dialogue, is the discussion that happens. Tell us how do we structure our dialogue so that it both moves the plot and enhances the setting? Mm.
Well, I think dialogue, this is a big, maybe the second big issue that we see in a lot of the writing. You know, dialogue is a tool. I use that word again.
No, I think it's an excellent tool.
No, it really is.
It is a tool.
I mean, there's nothing worse than bad dialogue. And we really should look at plays to study good dialogue. But I think dialogue has to reveal character, it has to propel the story forward, or it has to create conflict. And in my opinion, if it isn't doing any of those things, it probably needs to be cut. You know, dialogue, I think people don't understand, is highly stylized. You can't just put down what I'm saying because you need to get to the heart of the matter. So you don't want to have filler dialogue, which maybe we can talk about in a minute, and you don't want to have backstory that's... So those are the two big boo-boos that I see a lot.
I think it's difficult for new writers to make the dialogue authentic because essentially it does need to sound like the way the character really speaks. And yet at the same time, life is not art. You can't just write down the way we really speak. It would be full of empty phrases and padding. And one of the mistakes I see new writers make often is using words like, well, I don't know, I wonder, that totally empty phrases. They don't move the story forward. They don't really reveal anything. And if you cut that away, then what's left becomes so much more potent, so much more active in the story itself. I think the other mistake, and it's a very difficult skill to acquire, is making your characters sound different. So they're not all just a version of the writer, but that, you know, your 13-year-old girl and your story sounds completely different from her grandfather or the head of the corporation that she's wandered into. So that also requires a fine ear. It requires study. It requires taking notes. When I wrote short stories involving teenagers, believe me, I was following my teenagers around with a notepad and taking down even their slang to get it right.
Well, I'll just add to that because this is one of my things, which is, and Laura's already talked about that a bit, but the filler dialogue. You know, I always see manuscripts where the phone is ringing and we get, hello, Marcia, hello, Sue. You know, what are you doing? Oh, I'm having a cup of tea. Oh, that's great, Marcia. You know, by the way, Uncle Fred has died. Well, we don't need the filler. We want to get into the heart of the matter. We get into what is important and not the filler before and after. We don't need the hellos and the goodbyes or the, as Laura says, the wells and you knows. It needs to be set up and Uncle Fred has died. We get right to
it. Yeah. You know where you see this exemplified beautifully is on television. If you're watching any show, but take a sitcom where they've only really got 20 minutes of content for a 30-minute show at best, you'll notice every time the phone rings, no one says goodbye. They don't waste the 2 seconds it would take to have characters say goodbye. They just hang up. I'd encourage your listeners to watch for that next time and see how often that's the case.
Oh, I love. Hello. Fred died. I know you don't care, but I thought you should know. Goodbye.
The end.
No goodbye, though.
No goodbye,
just hang
though.
Up.
Oh, that's right.
And you just wasted 2 seconds.
It's the same thing you see with backstory. And playwrights have to be very clever about getting backstory into a script. But for novelists or short story writers, you know, you don't want to see a woman meeting her ex-husband and she says, oh, it's good to see you, Bruce, my ex-husband, who I hate with all my heart, right? And he says, yes, Stephanie, even though we divorced after 10 years of marriage because I was naughty. But you will see this. This is insulting to the reader because the two characters
I find it insulting and I'm not even reading.
I'm bored already.
So you have to be very careful with backstory that you're not using dialogue as a device to give the reader information. You have to find more clever ways or more sophisticated ways.
Well, that's a showing and telling issue, actually.
Yeah.
You can tell those things, but you're going to need to tell those, you know, as backstory, not trying
not
to
dialogue.
Stick it in your dialogue.
So different voice, then, is word choice, is phraseology.
Syntax.
What is syntax?
The way in which words are delivered on the page, the rhythm, the order in which you're using them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's the way you create, you create different voices.
Well, you know, yeah, sure. There are some of people who will be speaking in a very lyrical way and very poetic. There are characters who will use a lot of similes and metaphors naturally. There are others that will be very terse and clipped and short. And there will be people that speak more actively, more, you know, softly. So, yeah.
I think that that one of the most important things, it seems to me anyway, about dialogue that resonates is what you said earlier, Laura, the sense that you have to write the way people actually talk, but at the same time, you've got to form that so that it's literary, so you, in one sense, can't really write about the way people really
talk. It's got to be better. It's got to be better.
You have to form it somehow.
Yeah. Yeah, I have this this passage in the story within where this really happened, where I was standing in a store and at a makeup counter, and there were two teenage girls and an older gentleman there picking out some products. And I heard the man walk over to the girls and say, you have said the word like 27 times in the last minute, like this and like that. And really, I can't believe the way you speak nowadays. And the girl just looked at him and said, like, who cares?
But you raise a very, very good point about dialogue, because it would get incredibly boring to read all of those likes. And so you have to choose.
You can give the essence of what it is you're trying to get across. You can give, I guess what I always say is you don't bore your reader in order to convince them that a character is boring. You know, well, the same thing would be true of dialogue. I can let you know that this person is tedious without creating tedious dialogue.
No, I think that's really excellent. Excellent. There's a sense in which in our stories we tell too much, we describe too much. How do you teach people who want to write good literary fiction? How do you teach them to show what is going on rather than simply to describe what's going on?
Well, one way is what we've just been talking about. You see and hear a character in action, so you hear them speak. And it's when we go to Writing 101, they say, you know, bring your characters to life. And one way you can do that is having them have dialogue or see them in action rather than just summarizing for pages and pages and pages what's happened.
Well, yes, that's true. And I always say to people, what would you remember more, a birth you witnessed or a birth announcement? You know, one is something you're present for, and one is a telling about it after the fact. So what you're trying to do on the page, and it's not that telling isn't sometimes appropriate. It often is appropriate. You need both, the ability to both show and tell. But when something becomes flat, it's usually because the need to dramatize, the need to show is there. And it will bring a scene to life more so than almost any other element of craft. One way you do that is by simply presenting the evidence. I don't want to tell you that my character is angry. I want to show you. I want you to draw that conclusion yourself. I want you to see pursed lips or narrowed eyes or clenched fists or something perhaps less cliche that is actually very specific to the character of the person I'm describing, and even in memoir. So that the reader gets to say, ah, she is angry, or he is so deeply shamed. But I'm not putting the word shame out there as the author, and I'm not using the word angry either. I'm allowing you to make that judgment call yourself based on the evidence I'm giving. And if I do that well enough, you'll trust me more, and you'll be more actively engaged. We tend to turn off the minute we hear a label. If I tell you the guy was a real bully, it's sort of like we inherently go, oh, really? Says who? Show me.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's very, very accurate. It's kind of don't lecture me, but the angry person, the cliche, of course, but it's effective, is at the conference table, the pencil snapped in half. And you don't need to say very much more. You know something is going on with this character now. Well, humor. Humor is a very, very dangerous area.
Yes, it is.
How do you get humor where you want it in your story?
I think it's one of the most difficult things to do. And Laura's the funny one here, so I probably should let her talk about that. But right, I'll humor you. I think, though, it's a lot of humor that I like, and humor is subjective. You know, what you think is funny, I might not think is funny, right? But I think often humor can be found in the truth of things, and also if there's an inconsistency between what people expect to happen and then what happens.
I often think the funniest things happen off stage, too, that they aren't necessarily where we're looking for it. Humor is largely based on surprise. On our brains love that. We love the unpredictable. We love the punchline that carries with it a note of something unexpected. And it is true that it's subjective. Humor is, I respect a writer who can make a reader laugh almost more than any other. I think it's a most difficult skill. I think it's a lot easier to make someone cry than
it
is
to
make someone laugh.
How, what
well, I think it's important to not try to tell a joke, but tell a story and try to tell the truth. And I do think that it is in acute self-awareness and honesty that humor is found. It's going deeper till you find that little nugget that no one will admit, but everyone can identify with, and you bring that to light. And humor is such a connector, because the minute you laugh, even alone in your room with a book, you feel a certain camaraderie with the world at large, with everyone else who has that same fallibility, and it's an act of generosity that the writer has presented that fallibility to the world, and you can go, ah, yes, a member of my tribe. I'm not alone, and I'm not crazy.
So is dialogue a good place to do humor? Where does humor happen the most effectively, do you know?
It could certainly show up in dialogue. That'd be a great place. It could also show up, though, in a description. It can show up in people's reactions and characters' mm-hmm. reactions. I mean, you can insert dialogue anywhere, just again, as in real life, you would find a situation funny.
How about humor in the midst of tragedy?
Well, that certainly happens, because we disconnect in terms of urgency in times when we are under tremendous stress, mm-hmm. you know, people laughing at funerals and that kind of thing.
And you see that a lot, mm-hmm. right? You have to have some levity. And I think the most powerful books are a combination between dark and light. And so even in a tragedy, Laura was talking about the book Room, and one of the things I remember about that was the young narrator, you would kind of laugh at his innocence, I guess you would say, at naming the chair or the different things. And that gave this very dark story. So how else would you have levity? So I think the making the narrator a young child was a brilliant choice, because that's how she was able to, I don't know if you'd call it humor, but certainly a lightness and some levity added to that very dark space.
Well, we all want to write a story that sings, write the bird song. And so we want to revise. Mm-hmm. We want to work and we want to rework our stories. But we don't want to work them to death, as it were. How should we revise our stories? How should we look at them again?
Well, I feel that you need to write your draft as fast as possible and not worry. Get it out and look at it as a whole. And then you can begin tweaking and revising. I've seen so many times where people keep polishing the first 50 pages, and it does become overdone. And then also you don't have a good middle, and certainly you have a rushed and not perfect ending, because you spent so much time on that beginning. So I think get it out fast, and then you're revising as a whole, not one part that becomes almost overpolished. Having said that, I don't think anything is ever perfect, but at a certain point, you have to say it's enough for now, and I'll send it out into the world.
So what are you looking for when you revise?
Well, when I'm revising a piece, and I would agree with what Lynn just said, I always advise my students to write with abandon. Just get it out. Let it flow. Follow the energy. Let the story within out. Then worry about polishing it. There are writers, however, that would disagree with us because it's not their personal style. They belabor every sentence. Every sentence has to be crafted as a work of art. So, you know, this is subjective, and this is a matter of that personal writing style. However, I do think that letting yourself write without a censor, without trying to edit as you write, is probably, at least for me and for many of my students, the most efficient way of doing it. Then you bring in the critical editor. Then you bring in that fine eye. And one of the things I would say is cut your adjectives. Go back through. Adjectives are often a way of a kind of lazy man's way of telling and not showing. I would say go back through and elevate your choice of verbs. Go look at every verb you have. She looked at him. Well, there are 1,000 ways to look at someone. He walked down the street. Well, does that really mean he strolled? Which conveys an entirely different sense of what's going on. So I'd look at my word choice. I'd look at my phrasing. I would reorder, material, I would look to see whether, you know what, my first paragraph was actually just kind of a warm-up, a throat clearing. And I see now, upon revision, my story starts on page 2. Mm-hmm. That's where the action, that's the moment at which after nothing will ever be the same. So I think revision is hugely important. I never stop seeing something I could have done better, even when a work's been published.
So word choice is important, do you think? And how about letting your work sit for a while?
That's hugely important, don't you think, Glenn?
Yeah. I think if you have the luxury, some people are working on deadlines, but if you have the luxury of letting it sit for a while, you come back with a fresh eye. And the part that you thought you just couldn't cut, you can now easily cut because it really isn't significant to the overall plot. And it's just a tangent. Mm-hmm. But, you know, 3 weeks ago, you couldn't bear it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I would also just remind your listeners that when you cut material, don't ever throw it away and nothing's ever lost. Just create a great line stump, you know, and just take that paragraph out. And one thing I'll do if I'm not certain is I'll drop the font on that paragraph down to 5.5 and put a line through it, then read and see, do I even miss it? If I don't, then I know it's safe to remove it and put it in another file. If I do, then I haven't even wasted any time. I just bring the font back up.
Well, I think it's interesting to let things sit. And if you're like me, you all let things sit because
and you don't throw anything away. I could see from your expression before, which was why I was laughing.
Never throw anything away. But I have to admit that I have gone back to paragraphs that I've written and I've said, who in the world wrote this? I mean,
because it's so good.
My goodness, no, not because it's so good, not at all. But reading aloud is one way of revising.
It's a hugely important one.
And what do we do? What happens to us when we read our work aloud? What are we reading aloud for?
Well, I can tell you that when you read aloud, the ear can hear what the eye can't see, and the minute you read aloud, you will notice places you've repeated the same word twice within two lines. You'll also be able to hear places where the writing is really flat and needs to be dramatized, needs to be shown, because you'll find yourself wanting to read faster or skim, and particularly if you're reading aloud to someone else.
Glenn.
This is something, I think this is really important, and it's particularly with dialogue, but really everything. But playwrights do this all the time. This is a matter of course for playwrights. You gather your friends, fellow actors, and read it aloud, and you can instantly hear where the trouble is.
Well, I don't know if you would agree or not, but I read aloud for rhythm and for pace. Mm-hmm. And I can, when something falls apart, reading aloud, it jumps out at you. Or if you've got a run-on sentence, you have to take a deep breath and say, wait a minute. Well, I want to thank both of you for coming today and joining us in this discussion about craft. And I want to say to our readers, all of you out there, to our writers and our readers, the holidays are coming and all the relatives are gathering and there will be stories in abundance around the table. In fact, the gathering itself might even be a story. Here at Delmarva Public Radio, we would like to see your work. If you feel you have written a good story that uses the elements of craft that we have talked about today, send it to me, Harold Wilson, here at Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition, in care of this station, delmarvapublicradio.net. And who knows, if your story is good, then you might be invited to read it on the air. Please, your own unpublished material only, written recently, no old stuff out of the drawer, no longer than 5 minutes reading time, and please submit it by the end of November. Details will also be on the Delmarva Public Radio website. So get to writing, apply these elements of craft, and send us here at Delmarva Public Radio your best work. And who knows, lightning could strike. Lynn and Laura, thank you again for joining me today with your wisdom on the elements of craft and your encouragement for our listeners out there. And thanks to all of you for listening. This is Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson.
You've been listening to a special Writer's Edition of Delmarva Today with your host, Harold Wilson. This program is produced on the campus of Salisbury University for Delmarva Public Radio. Christopher Rank is your audio engineer. Mary Seaman is the volunteer producer. Visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, for podcasts of this program.